from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Donald Trump told ABC yesterday that he may not alert the FBI if foreign governments offer damaging information about an opponent in the upcoming presidential race. Coming up on Forum, we talk about the president's statement, which is being widely criticized, with longtime conservative commentator George Will. In his new book, The Conservative Sensibility, Will argues that the Republican Party has lost its way with an overpowering executive who is putting democracy at risk.
The party, stripped of its animating principles, has become a cult. It inevitably happens in politics. That's when the cult of personality emerges.
George Will joins us to discuss his book and more, why he left the Republican Party, all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. For more than four decades, Washington Post columnist and Pulitzer Prize winner George Will has written about politics and civic life through the lens of a self-described constitutional conservative. In 2016, George Will famously left the Republican Party to protest the nomination of Donald Trump as the GOP's candidate for the presidency. Now he is out with a new book titled The Conservative Sensibility, which explores the Founding Fathers' vision of effective government and argues for a return to the party's core principles of separation of powers, financial prudence, and small government. He joins us now to discuss his new book and a number of other things, and welcome, George Will.
Glad to be with you.
Glad to have you with us. I've always wanted to talk baseball with you, but there are too many other things to talk about. So,
I only write about politics to support my baseball habit.
Yeah, well, it's been a long interest of mine, that habit of yours, yeah. But so has the other things you write about. And you write a lot, of course, about current events and about things that are going on in the news. And I want to get to your book because there's much in there to talk about. But before I do, I'd like to get your response to a couple of major news stories. Maybe from the conservative point of view that you have taken on in this book. And the first one that I'd like to hear you talk about is what went on with President Trump recently on ABC with George Stephanopoulos. Essentially, he said, I take it if a foreign power came to him and said, we've got dirt on a candidate in 2020. And this has caused a good deal of outrage, even from Chris Wray and the FBI, who he's gone, well, head to head with on this. He says Chris Wray is wrong because Chris Wray said this would be a tantamount to defiance of what our Constitution says and what it provides. So let me just get to this right away. From a conservative perspective, the president is doing something or is advocating something clearly that is wrong here, isn't he?
He is, but in a way he's keeping a campaign promise. Part of his campaign promise was that I'm against the norms. I'm going to campaign against the established norms of our campaigning. And I promise to continue doing this when I get into power, if I get into power. This is a man who did not undergo any apprenticeship in public life. He had less experience in public life, civilian or military, than anyone ever elected president. And it shows a certain blithe indifference to what would be to people who have been immersed in and marinated by the rules and ethos of our public life would be clear violations.
Well, I know you have serious criticism of President Trump. We may get to that in the course of this hour. But the fact of the matter is that we now have some strong tensions. And you write about Iran in your book, strong tensions going on in the Straits of Hormuz with oil tankers. And I'm wondering, you know, there are those, for example, who say despite all of his flaws, character flaws and temperament flaws, that President Trump maybe is the Pacific voice when it comes to war with Iran compared to Pompeo and Bolton.
Well, we know very much where Mr. Bolton stands because he's been a public advocate. He's the Metternich of many green rooms here in Washington and has advocated as much interventionism as is possible. I think he still believes that the invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003 was a good idea, which means he's not easily discouraged by counter-evidence. Clearly, it seems to me, Mr. Trump's instincts are to avoid foreign entanglements. Whether or not those instincts will prevail against other instincts that he has, and he's utterly instinctual in these matters, that is a desire to be a winner, a desire to be a big-chested he-man and all the rest, when people start working out their their inner anxieties in foreign policy, of batting down the hatches.
Talking to George Will, and I should mention that he will be appearing at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco on June 26th at 6:30, and he is the author of a new book called The Conservative Sensibility, which we will be talking about. One more thing I would like your response to, though, and that is the census and the idea that we should be able to ask people, or so the advocates say, whether they are American citizens.
Well, people have been asked that over the years in many censuses. The question here is largely about the motivation of Secretary of Commerce Ross in wanting to reinstate this kind of question. The feeling was that it would depress the responses and therefore skew subsequent allocations of congressional seats and redistricting. I think with the Supreme Court, which is going to rule on this certainly by the end of the month, so any day now, they're going to ask less about the Secretary's motivations and more about whether or not this is a power clearly vested in the Secretary of Commerce to shape the form of the census questionnaires. So I have a feeling, my feeling is, A, he'll win, B, he dissembled and probably lied about this, but that will not be dispositive.
When we talk about conservatism, which you write about in your book, we're talking, as I said earlier, about limited government and separation of powers. And now when you have people like Wilbur Ross being sent subpoenas by the House of Representatives, not only Wilbur Ross, but many others, including our Attorney General, what does a conservative say about the fact that stonewalling is going on and that, I mean, there's always been a refusal throughout our history to meet with subpoenas in many instances from the House of Representatives, but where is their power here when they're just being stonewalled?
Well, I can only speak for this conservative. On the one hand, we have a historic experience of abusive congressional investigations. Executive privilege in its modern form was somewhat strengthened by General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower's resistance to the investigatory committee of Joseph McCarthy and his Senate subcommittee. That said, this also is said, this kind of conservative who very much resents the elephantitis of the presidency, this terrible, swollen office that now has upset the constitutional equilibrium of our Madisonian system. It's nice to see signs of intelligent life in Congress, signs that Congress is thinking of itself as an independent branch. People are always saying Congress is a co-equal branch. I disagree with that. I'm the traditional conservative who believes that congressional supremacy is the logic of the Constitution. It is Article I for a reason. The president's duties, which are outlined in the rather spare Article II, his primary duty is to take care that the laws are faithfully executed, which makes him inherently subordinated to the legislature that makes the laws for him to execute. So one of the things we're reaping here with the arrogance of this president and of many recent presidents is that for 80 years now, Congresses under both parties have been spinning off power to presidents of both parties. It's a bipartisan failing that has produced the modern presidency.
So when we look at Attorney General Barr, for example, defending all of this executive power and executive privilege, we are looking at someone who, well, from your perspective as a conservative, is defying what our Constitution is investing.
He is indeed, but he's doing what attorneys general have been doing, again, of both parties for years. The one great mistake my hero Madison made was he said in the Federalist Papers that you, in a popular government, a popular sovereignty, the legislative branch will suck all power into its impetuous vortex. Indeed, for 80 years now, Congress under both parties has been spinning off power, spinning it over to the executive, delegating powers they have no right to delegate, getting away with this because the Supreme Court has stopped trying to enforce a non-delegation doctrine on the legislature. Just look at the news in the last few days. The Congress seemingly helpless to prevent a president from repurposing money appropriated for purpose A is instead taken for purpose B, say to build a wall. Congress seems incapable of stopping the president, although it has a technical right to, to sell arms to Saudi Arabia and its allies in the civil war in Yemen. Congress, unable to prevent a president from declaring emergencies promiscuously and imposing taxes, which tariffs are, unilaterally. The Daily News is a case study in the argument of my book about the costs of the progressive, frankly, revolution that put aside the separation of powers and gave us the modern presidency.
The Republican Party, certainly the conservative core of the Republican Party, was always against tariffs because it was really against the free market. And so we have a president not only who is imposing tariffs, but we have a president, executive branch of government that's saying we'll subsidize farmers, for example. We'll provide welfare for those farmers.
Yeah, this is a classic case of what my friend Pat Moynihan called iatrogenic government. Iatrogenic ailment is an ailment caused by a doctor or medicine. And the government now is, our iatrogenic government applied to agriculture is, we'll give you $15 billion to partially heal the wounds that we have caused with our tariffs. I mean, it's a complete absurdity. If you're setting out to discredit government, you could hardly start better.
Talking with George Will, again, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist, two Pulitzers under his belt, and author of The Conservative Sensibility. This was your party for many years, and it's certainly always been the party of conservatives. And when are they going to start, speaking up?
Well, don't hold your breath. The Republican Party has traditionally been riven by strong arguments. In 1912, Teddy Roosevelt, wanting to get back into the White House, goes to war against his former vice president, against his friend, his protege, William Howard Taft. This progressive against conservative Republican split reemerged in the 1940s with New York Governor Tom Dewey, the candidate of Eastern liberal republicanism, and Robert Taft of Ohio, the senator of the conservatives. 1960s, it was Barry Goldwater and the conservatives against the Rockefeller Republicans. Today, however, this president has a more united party behind them than any Republican, perhaps ever. At the 500-day mark of Reagan's presidency, he had the support of 77% of Republicans. At the 500-day mark of Mr. Trump's presidency, he had the support of 87% of Republicans, and I think today it's higher.
And when you think about particularly the leadership in the Republican Party, Mitch McConnell essentially saying, this is zero-sum politics, isn't it, that we're seeing now? I mean, he says, for example, I'll block this Supreme Court nomination because it's coming from Obama. I'll do everything I can to block Obama and to interfere with his presidency. I'll do everything I can to ensure that Kavanaugh's on the Supreme Court. It's not only following, let's say, the Pied Piper of Donald Trump, it's also establishing rules that say, well, our interests, Machiavellian though they may be in terms of the way we see to their fruition, are what comes primary.
I know that Mitch McConnell, who I've known for decades, is reticent about his feelings concerning the president. I know Keith feels the following. He says, the Senate is in the personnel business. It is our job to advise and consent to the staffing of the upper reaches of the executive branch and particularly the staffing of the Article III courts. So he has decided to bow his neck, keep his head down, and fill the government as much as possible with a lasting legacy of conservative judges in particular. There is, I can tell you, zero affection in the Republican Party for the man to whom they are tugging their forelocks and being obedient.
Well, we're talking to George Will, as I remind you. I want to get back to this idea of a conservative sensibility with you and what a conservative sensibility really is. I think about people like William F. Buckley, who I had the privilege of interviewing many years ago, or William Rush, people from the National Review. They're probably also horrified by the temperament and the character and the actions of this president. They've certainly, many of them, said so. And it gets to another strain of conservatism that you bring up in your book. And that is the idea that conservatives need to be responsible, that conservatism involves a certain degree of courtesy and restraint and prudence, all of those things which have run amok in this administration.
Well, quite so. Those who support Trump say, look, he cut corporate taxes. Well, Barack Obama was for cutting the corporate tax rate, which was an anomaly. It was so high. They say, and any Republican would have wanted to cut taxes. They say, well, Donald Trump's doing the conservative work of deregulation. Any Republican president would be doing this. They say he's appointing conservative judges. Any Republican president would be selecting judges from a list probably approved by, certainly would have been approved by, the Federalist Society, of which I am, by the way, a card-carrying member. What makes Donald Trump unique and distinctive is the coarseness, the constant dishonesty, the behavior that would get any of our 10-year-old children sent to bed without dessert. This kind of sleepy Joe Biden, this quoting, actually misquoting the head of North Korea, referring to Joe Biden as a low IQ idiot and doing this abroad. I mean, again, this is the complete indifference to not just the norms of our politics, but elementary politeness.
How do you call someone a low IQ idiot when you confuse, for example, Mars as being part of the moon and things of that sort?
Yeah. Well, remember, this is a man who, in one of the Republican debates, for reasons I don't remember, felt called upon to defend the conservatism of his sister, a federal judge, doing which he said, my sister has signed some of the same bills that Justice Alito has signed. Now, this is a man who thinks judges sign bills. This is a man, therefore, who would flunk a sixth-grade civics exam, and now he has control of the executive branch of government. It's you laugh that you may not weep.
Well, he's also said that if he is impeached, he will sue. It shows a great deal of perspicacity, too. I'm just wondering, though, since I brought up impeachment, you had an article, and I should say that George Will is syndicated in about 300 newspapers. You had an article about impeachment, and you said maybe as an aesthetic consideration, but all that incessant lying, all that contemptible coarseness that has been certainly described by you and others where the president is concerned doesn't necessarily lead to impeachment and shouldn't necessarily lead to impeachment.
Well, there are two purposes of impeachment. One is to punish actions already undertaken. And that was the Nixon impeachment, a retrospective impeachment. And I don't know how you impeach Donald Trump for, say, firing James Comey. You have to, A, that was an exercise of a core presidential power to staff the executive branch. They can say, well, he did it with a corrupt motive, which might be true, but the corrupt motive was to prevent the investigation into an offense that the investigation actually proceeded to find didn't occur. So that's a pretty thin reed on which to overturn a presidential election. A prospective use of impeachment, a prophylactic measure, if you will, which is to prevent additional damage to this public good and, in Madison's terms, the society as a whole. That would be the damage done daily by this coarsening of our discourse. You cannot unring a bell, and this bell that he's been ringing is going to change forever. Well, forever is a long time. Going to change for the foreseeable future. The way we treat each other in public life and deepen the fissures and animosities. This, it seems to me, is going to do inevitably more lasting damage to the country than Nixon's surreptitious burglaries did, because they were, A, done in secret, and when exposed, promptly led to his downfall and to the punishment of the perpetrators. But it's very difficult to impeach a president for being exactly what we knew him to be on election day and exactly as he promised to be. That is, he has said, I've campaigned as a kind of lout and I'm going to govern as one. And he's kept his promise. So I don't see how you impeach a man for keeping promises that helped him win the election.
Does he describe himself as a lout? Is he on record as that?
No, I did. That's my help for him.
Let me get you to a couple of, I think, important ideas that need to be fleshed out from your book. And one is the role of limited government, particularly where a woman's right to choose or reproductive rights are concerned. The government, certainly the libertarian argument, many libertarians say, should not interfere. And a conservative argument would seem to, support that idea. Where do you stand?
I'm pro-life. It seems to me clear that not as important as a matter of abstruse theology, but of elemental biology. There are two beings here. And attention must be paid to that. I am not one of those who thinks that abortion is a realm of unsplittable differences. It seems to me that we ought to be able to have a much more moderate abortion regime, one resembling those in almost all the European countries. I don't think there's any European country that has an abortion regime as permissive as ours. Here's a thought experiment for you. What would America's abortion regime be if the number of months in the gestation of a human infant were a prime number, 7, 11, 13? That is, what if Justice Blackmun hadn't been able to discover some constitutional significance in the fact that 9 is divisible by 3, and therefore that trimesters should have constitutional significance? I just think this is an issue on which the country has sensibly said, A, we do not want abortion banned. B, we're extremely uneasy with late-term abortions. And that suggests to you where the compromise should lie.
Is there a compromise when you have limited government, when it comes to helping those who are homeless or in abject poverty, or when it comes, for that matter, for government playing a role in terms of racial inequities?
No conservative that I know is opposed to ameliorative government. The most effective anti-poverty program we have had in the last 50 years is the Earned Income Tax Credit, which Ronald Reagan substantially enlarged because it embodies certain conservative values, which is, in order to be eligible for this entitlement, you must be doing something socially useful, which is have an earned income, have a job.
Again, we're talking to George F. Will. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and author of The Conservative Sensibility. He'll be appearing at the Commonwealth Club June 26th here in San Francisco at 6:30. In the meantime, let me invite our listeners to respond to anything you've heard from George Will thus far in our conversation, or bring up any questions you might have. We're talking about conservative sensibility, talking about the news as well, and let's hear from you, our listeners. You can join us now at our toll-free number, and I invite you to do that. The number to call is 866-733-6786, and please feel free to be part of the program. Again, you can join us at 866-733-6786, or you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have for George Will on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but please feel free to be part of the program. We're seconds away from a break here. I've got to ask you, often you're described as a Tory. Do you embrace that, or do you find it repulsive?
I've once called myself that. I'm really not a Tory, and that's a European conservatism, and ours in America is interestingly superior.
Again, we'll continue our conversation with George Will, and we may revisit that as well as other things when we return. Stay tuned. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this Forum Hour with George Will, columnist for The Washington Post, and also the author of a book called The Conservative Sensibility. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco June 26th at 6:30, and we're going to go forthwith to your calls and your emails. Just a couple of quick questions, George. I'd like to ask you, can you be a conservative? You've said in your book that you're an atheist. Can you be a conservative without God? There are many conservative Catholics and evangelicals and Orthodox Jews who would say no.
I know they would, and there are a lot of my readers assume that I'm a Catholic because I'm pro-life, but it doesn't follow. I think Bill Buckley put it perfectly. He said a conservative need not be religious but cannot despise religions, and I certainly do not. The great durable religions of the world respond to strong, perennial human longings and aspirations. I'm the son of a professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois. I grew up in an entirely secular family. The question simply never arose, and I actually majored in religion in college to find out what was going on, but I've never had the need or needed the hypothesis.
I've got a listener here who is taking exception to language you use. This is Kimberly, who says, abortion regime, please challenge him on that language. There is no abortion regime. There is the law of the land, which is Roe versus Wade.
Well, I'm using regime the way Aristotle did, as the set of laws that govern behavior. It's hardly a loaded term.
What do you also say, I'm curious to know, about the argument that Donald Trump is simply the logical consequence, if you will, or the logical extension, trajectory of the Republican Party and its positions all along, and particularly the argument goes what started with the Tea Party now has been wrought with Donald Trump?
Well, I think that's absurd. The Tea Party was a group of people aroused by excessive spending in the government. You may disagree with them on that, but to go from that to Donald Trump's kind of coarse populism is, it seems to me, absurd.
And the argument that Donald Trump has done away with regulations to the extent that that has done a great deal for the economy and has enhanced the economy?
Well, A, he hasn't has hardly done away with regulations.
I didn't mean in toto. I meant a lot of regulations,
yeah.
Obviously.
Walk into Senator Mike Lee of Utah's office, and you'll see two stacks of papers. One is about 4 inches high, and that's the legislation Congress did in a recent session. The other stack of papers is 8 feet high. It's the rules and regulations generated by the administrative state, by the semi and actually autonomous institutions of the executive branch in the same period. This demonstrates the marginalization of Congress, the inexorable flow of power to the executive branch, and it seems to me a correction of some sort was in order.
Here's Jeff, who writes, I continue to be absolutely dumbfounded that conservatives don't want to conserve the planet. It is the largest failure of the conservative movement. They are not conservatives. They are business people who want money and to sacrifice the planet.
Well, it's a passing strange interpretation of recent history to believe that the American big business community is opposed to environmental regulations. It's simply not the case. And it seems to me odd to say that most Americans are in some way, or all Americans who vote conservative are in some way beholden to large economic entities.
If we have a president, though, who's a climate denier and the Republicans are solidly behind this president, doesn't that mean, in effect, that they are also climate deniers?
Well, I find climate denier not only sophomoric but sinister. It's obviously a sophomoric way of associating people who are skeptical about some of the environmental claims with Holocaust deniers. But beyond that, I mean, I've been called a climate denier, which strikes me as amusing because the one thing everyone can agree on is that, of course, the climate is changing because it always has been, always is, and always will be changing. I grew up in central Illinois, where at one point the place where I grew up was under 100 feet of ice. The idea that the climate is in some way static and should be frozen is absurd. Now, I'm not denying, of course, that human activity or the activity of 7 to 8 billion people can affect the climate. I am saying that there are enormous complexities in climate science that the so-called party of science seems to be denying. The New Yorker magazine, when the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued one of its recent reports, began its story saying, the panel's report, which should be but unfortunately will not be taken as the last word on climate science. Now, try and plug in the last word on neuroscience, the last word on molecular biology. That's not the nature of science. I'm the son of a philosopher whose specialty was the philosophy of science, and I find some of this simply weird way to talk. I'm curious about the course of the planet. I have children, and I have 7 grandchildren. I'm not uninterested in this, but I would like some of the people who say, A, they know what's causing climate change, and B, they know where it's going to go. I'd like to have them explain to me what caused the medieval warming period, probably the most consequential period of climate change on record. And one thing we know is it was not caused by carbon emissions from industrialized countries.
Well, we need a whole hour on this, but we've got lots of calls and lots more to talk about with George Will. Let me get a caller on here, and that's Carrie. You're our first caller up. Welcome.
Good morning. I wanted to ask Mr. Will if he will appeal to people here today to vote out people like Mitch McConnell and others who won't stand up for the rule of law and even go against common sense legislation to secure our election.
Well, the people of Kentucky every 6 years are invited to throw out Mr. McConnell, and he keeps coming back. He will have another tough race, but Kentucky, as you know, is an extremely Trump-sympathetic state. I'm not sure quite what the caller has in mind when saying violating the laws. We ought to be able to talk about our political differences without criminalizing them. And it seems to me an awful lot of our argument becomes embittered because people tend to say that people who disagree with me must somehow be violating the law. There's a lot of room for argument within the law.
Let me thank the caller. Although there are those who are saying that the president has violated the rule of law and he is not above the law. You have heard this, I'm sure.
I've heard, I keep hearing that Donald, like no one was earlier or more strenuous in disapproving Donald Trump than I was and am. That said, people who say he's an incipient tyrant are not reading the newspapers. This is a man who can't get his two recent nominees to the Federal Reserve Board confirmed. I'll tell you what tyrants do. Tyrants ban newspapers, ban trade unions, and invade Czechoslovakia and Poland. That's what a tyrant looks like. Donald Trump is exasperatingly to him weak. There's very little that the man can actually accomplish.
Don't tyrants also blame the news and the media as being enemies of the people?
Sure, they do that kind of rhetoric, but tyrants tyrannize. And whatever you want to say about Donald Trump, he is not tyrannizing people. Offending them, yes. Appalling them, yes. Causing some public costs, yes. But this is not tyranny.
Let me bring another.
We've had good experiences, good, solid educational experiences with tyranny in the 20th century. This is not what that looks like.
Here's Pat joining us. Pat, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. So I wanted to go back to what Mr. Will said about the fact that Donald Trump may be a lout, but we can't impeach a lout. He's done what he said he would do. I am under the impression that he's clearly violated the Emoluments Clause. Isn't that a high crime and misdemeanor? Doesn't that rise to that? And then I have...
Actually, the content of the phrase high crimes and misdemeanor is whatever Congress at any particular moment says it is. That is, it's a political judgment. And if they wanted to say that, they will. Overturning a presidential election is an enormously important decision to take. And what amazes me about the Democrats running for their party's presidential nomination right now is the amount of time they are spending on things they know are not going to happen, including removing the president. They can impeach him. Clinton was impeached. Nixon was impeached. Andrew Johnson was impeached. That is, articles of impeachment can be voted, but removal from office requires the Senate vote, and it's not going to happen, and everyone knows it.
What about emoluments, though? I mean, that certainly has come up over and over again as a transgression possibility for this president to be impeached.
Well, I would warn my Democratic friends against going to the country saying we're going to overturn a presidential election because he's profiting from the Trump Hotel down the road from the White House because so many foreign guests currying favor stay there. That's a thin reed on which to do something as momentous as overturning an election.
I don't know if you can answer this question, George. It's from a listener named Robert, because few of us are very adept at reading the mind of this president, such as it is. But he says, does George Will think the president believes in democracy as a form of government?
I think he believes in any form of government that elects him. And since he won an election, I think to that extent he believes in democracy. But
He likes tyrants, though. He certainly likes tyrants.
Well, I think he envies Orban and Duarte and others like this. But remember, as someone has well said about him, he's a weak man's idea of a strong man. He resembles P.G. Woodhouse in, I've read 73 of his novels, I'm an addict. P.G. Woodhouse invented a character called Sir Roderick Spode. It was a thinly disguised Sir Oswald Mosley, the leader of the British Union of Fascists in the 1930s. And with a great comic touch, P.G. Woodhouse deployed this character periodically. That's Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a painfully insecure, desperately weak person who, in any conversation about anything, knows he's out of his depth. And I really think it would help if people would stop ascribing to him theories and forethought. He doesn't have the one, and he doesn't do the other.
And here's Brian, our next caller. Brian, join us. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. It is really a pleasure to speak to George Will. I've described Donald Trump as the worst messenger for the best message. But George Will is against the tariffs that I think are the signature policy of this president. He's looked at the history of tariffs going back to the last five decades and what it's done to the country, and he's been objecting to it for all that time. And now that we see a return to tariffs, we do see a return to the United States' trajectory of growth. At least the green shoots of that are now showing up, and they should continue. I would ask George Will, would he not reconsider his policy or his opinion against tariffs and consider that a theory should bow to evidence? And if the United States is doing better with tariffs, shouldn't he reconsider his objection to tariffs and maybe also reconsider open borders as being not a good thing?
Brian, thank you for those questions. Let's go to Mr. Will. Yeah.
The last one first. I'm not for open borders. That is, I think control of borders is an essential attribute of all nations' sovereignties. I am for substantial high levels of immigration because we have an aging workforce that needs replenished as the baby boomers retire. We have 7 million unfilled jobs in this country now, and we have people banging on the door to get into the country and go to work. So I'm for a high level of immigration, particularly a high level of high-quality immigration that meets the needs of our increasingly information-centered economy. To go back to free trade, if there's anything that economists have agreed upon in the last 50 years, it is the virtues of free trade. And the caller asks about evidence. The explosive growth of our country and the Mexican economy, by the way, as a result of the liberalization of trade under NAFTA. The post-war recovery of shattered Europe, destroyed Japan, under the healing benefits of international global trade is evidence that can hardly be counterbalanced by the fact that the American economy is growing between 2% and 3%, which is hardly unprecedentedly robust at a time of tariffs with which we've had about 2 years experience now. That's hardly evidence against the efficacy of free trade.
Let me thank the caller for the question, and let me read a question from a listener named Daniel who wants to know, would returning to core principles actually mean shedding decades-long positions of the Republican Party or simply a return of 5 years to pre-Trump conservatism?
Well, it would require a return to a sense of the modest capacities of government, a real debate about the proper scope and actual competence of government. Just watch what's going to happen in 2020 when the Trump administration campaigns against what it calls socialism on the Democratic Party. This is a Trump administration that recently reauthorized the Export-Import Bank, which is known for good reason as Boeing's bank. The Export-Import Bank allocates capital to favored politically favored corporations. If that isn't a definition of part of socialism, I don't know what is. This is an administration that, with protectionism, is telling the American people what they can buy in what quantities and at what prices. That is government direction of the economy, which is one of the definitions of socialism. This is an administration that talks about repatriating our supply chains. Now, just think about that. Do these people have any idea what the supply chain of a Boeing Dreamliner is, how many countries these things flow from? This is the classic case of the fatal conceit, as Hayek called it, that you can intervene in complex social systems and control the consequences. Many of us are conservatives who do not just recognize the law of unintended consequences. We are conservatives because of the law of unintended consequences, which is that when you intervene in complex social systems, the unintended consequences of your intervention are apt to be larger than and contrary to the intended consequences.
And isn't it fair to say also that what archetypal or quintessential conservatism is all about is kind of fiscal parsimony and vanquishing deficits?
Absolutely. And here's what the big story that I think everyone's missing. For all the talk about discord in America today, and God knows it's real enough, what's most alarming is a consensus. And it's as broad as the Republic and deep as the Grand Canyon, and it's simply this. From the left side of the political spectrum to the far right, everyone in the political class has agreed that we should have a large, generous entitlement state and not pay for it. Everyone has agreed that we should give the American people a dollar's worth of government and charge them 80 cents for it, and to send 25% of the bill, or 20% of the bill, to the unconsenting, because unborn, future generations. I believe that the political class is more united by this self-interest than they are divided by ideology. The fact, simple truth, is that this is decadence. We used to borrow money for the future. We built drams and rivers and harbors and bridges and fought wars for the future. Now we're borrowing money from the future in order to finance our own consumption of current goods and services. And if that isn't decadent democracy, I don't know what is.
We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist George Will, author of The Conservative Sensibility, and we'll bring another caller aboard here, and that's you. Jack, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hi. You know, I'm a Democrat, but I've always been attracted to this gentleman's intellect. But when I listen to him talk about climate change, I cannot understand it. If you look at about the last 60 years of carbon of development from during a scientific period when we've understood how much carbon's in the atmosphere, and you look at it now, it's going almost straight up, asymptotically. The carbon level is just going straight up. It used to be going up and down and up and down very gradually, slowly increasing from 60 years ago till now. But now it's going almost straight up, Mr. Will.
You're absolutely right. The carbon in the atmosphere is going up. And that's half the measurement we need to have. The other half is we need to know what the consequences are. And we need to know how, if at all, the oceans can cope with this and other extremely complicated aspects of the extremely still opaque climate science.
I think your book is still speculative. I think that you take that position, don't you?
Exactly. And I would say one other thing. All the Democratic candidates for president are saying that this is literally a matter of life and death, that this is an existential threat to humanity. But they don't go the next step. Look, if carbon is as dangerous as they say it is, and if they are right in their projections, every one of them should be advocating a carbon tax. They're not. And I ask you why. It would be easier to believe their dire predictions if their prescriptions prescriptions met their rhetoric.
Well, let's stay on point here for a moment and get your response to a comment from a listener named Mark, who says, George Will seems to think that the cause of climate change in the past has some bearing on what is happening now with climate change. It is a disingenuous, non-logical argument. Climate change now is being caused by human activity. Climate change in the past was not caused by human activity. We have the ability to control our human activities.
We do have the ability to control human activities, and there are those who say it would be wonderful to emancipate the government to control every aspect of human activity, and there are those of us who suspect that that, as much as climate worry, is the real objective here. However, the fact that we did have substantial climate change disruptions, such as the medieval warming period, such as the Little Ice Age four centuries later, does suggest that we ought to be at least open, as the scientific mind teaches us to be, at least open to the possibility that there are things such as solar activity that we simply do not understand as contributors to climate change.
Talking about a whole range of issues with George Will, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist and author of The Conservative Sensibility, a political question from Daniel, who wants to know, do you think the Democrats should campaign on the premise that they will indict Trump when he leaves office? Is this a wise campaign promise for anyone to make?
I don't think so. I mean, they ought to campaign on issues that will help them win. It seems to me their first objective, and the one which I would wholeheartedly support them, is that it's time to remove this man from public life. Instead, they're campaigning on things that I think individually and particularly cumulatively cause an enormous number of moderate Americans to say, who are these people and why are they wasting their time on this? I mean, frankly, we're not going to abolish the Electoral College. It's not going to happen. We know that. We're not going to abolish private health insurance. What a way to begin a campaign by promising to offend 180 million Americans who have employer-provided health insurance and rather like it. All this energy devoted on things that American people are not worrying about, including, by the way, impeachment, and particularly in concluding whether or not to prosecute Donald Trump after he leaves office.
Rick wants to know, what is Mr. Will's take on the situation in Hong Kong? Does he think China is violating the Sino-British Joint Declaration in regards to the turnover?
I think they are. I think that Hong Kong, where, by the way, one of my children lives, is an outpost of prosperity and freedom, and it is incumbent upon the United States. There are three places where hugely prosperous and successful societies are threatened by China, two by China and one by North Korea. One is South Korea, one is Hong Kong, and one is Taiwan. Right today, Hong Kong is the flashpoint, and it is enormously heartening to see a million people pour into the streets in a prosperous society, standing up for an abstraction, but something that's quite real to them, freedom of speech and freedom from an extradition process that would subject them to the cruelties and opacities of the what we'll smilingly call the mainland Chinese justice system.
How does Mr. Will, Emma tweets, what does Mr. Will think about Mitch McConnell not allowing the Senate to vote on security legislation while taking money from voting machine companies?
I think voting security is a tremendously important issue, and we ought to move on it. We have such a ramshackle voting system. You'd think, my Lord, we ought to be able to manage to cast votes and to count the votes. And by the way, to have voters who do not stand in line as they do in various places in Florida for 3 and 4 hours. That's ridiculous.
Let me actually go to another listener caller. We're going to go to Patricia in Oakland. Patricia, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Could Mr. Will square the fact that every Democratic president since Carter has had a budget surplus, while every Republican has had a deficit, with the conservative supposed belief in balanced budgets? And on another note, could he cite any one of Europe's more stringent laws on abortion? Thank you.
Sure. With regard to the latter, in Britain, France, Germany, abortion after at least, at the latest, 20 weeks is much more restricted than it is in our country, where you essentially have unlimited abortion on demand. With regard to the surpluses, the caller is simply mistaken. Barack Obama did not run a surplus. Bill Clinton did run a surplus briefly because he had the good sense to become president just as we were making a commodity out of the Internet, and the Internet boom was underway. But both parties are complicit, and both parties are in the deficits, and both parties are indifferent to the deficits equally.
What do you make out of the fact that, your newspaper, The Washington Post, has counted up literally thousands of lies by this president, and certainly they and other members of the enemy of the people vanguard here, that is the New York Times, Washington Post, and so forth, that the president calls the enemy of the people, have pretty much criticized the president and kept that criticism moving steadily. But when you think about the Obama administration, if Obama had done anything even resembling not only lying, but the kinds of things that have come out of the Trump administration, there really is a double standard. And I think it's something that has to be broached and discussed. But why does it exist, and why does it continue to exist, in your judgment?
Well, there is a double standard, but there's a double standard on both sides. A lot of the people who are rightly criticizing Donald Trump for his executive overreach did not criticize Barack Obama for his "I have a phone and I have a pen" overreach on things like immigration policy. Again, there's a bipartisan abuse of executive power, and until we quit treating it as a merely partisan issue, we're not going to begin to cure it.
We'll leave it there. George Will, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it very much.
And KQED Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, Susan Britton, and Angela Correll. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producer is Vianne Alderete. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Interns are Caroline Smith and Sand Klein Markman. Executive editor, Ethan Lindsay. Chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.